John, Revelation, the 13th chapter. We had left off with our discussions in verses 3 and 4. What we would like to do is, Sister Connie, could you read for us Revelation 13, verses 1 through 9, please?
And I saw beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns 10 diadems, and upon its heads a name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and its feet were as the feet of a bear, and its mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave it its power and its throne and great authority. And I saw one of its heads as though it had been smitten unto death, and its death stroke was healed, and the whole earth wondered after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, and who is able to war with it? And there was given to it a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and there was given to it authority to continue 42 months. And it opened its mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, even them that dwell in the heaven. And there was given to it authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. And all that dwell on the earth shall worship him, every one whose name hath not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that hath been slain. If any man hath an ear, let him hear.
Okay, thank you very much. So, brethren, we've discussed this beast is the papacy. It is a religious government or a religion with a government and of itself. The Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, does have, as it were, joint branches. They have their equivalents to ambassadors. But the thought is that we're seeing this, the papacy gaining control over the Roman Empire as it emerges from the old Roman Empire, as Constantine first opened that way. And then we read in the 12th chapter and studied how there was the battle between the civil authority in the emperors and the courtiers against the Bishop of Rome and his clergy, as it were, and that eventually the Bishop of Rome prevailed and the papacy prevailed and developed. And so we start that particularly with 533, with Justinian the First declaring that the Bishop of Rome was the head of all bishops, and that in fact the western portion of Justinian's empire was practically represented by the Bishop of Rome, who was always there with the people. And then in 539, Belisarius, Justinian's general, defeated the Ostrogoths at Ravenna, and that helped solidify the situation for the Bishop of Rome. And then in the late 700s, Pippin the Short, followed by his son Charlemagne, Charles the Great, they defeated the Lombards in Italy, and thereby again supporting the Bishop of Rome. And then they granted to the papacy the Papal States, a large section of land across the midsection of Italy, and the Pope in return, surprisingly to Charlemagne, crowned Charlemagne on Christmas Day of 800 AD. This was the first time, as it were, that a Pope crowned the king. And hence starts our 1,000-year-long counterfeit millennium, ending in 1799 with Napoleon taking the Pope prisoner twice. And at one point, the Pope dies in prison, breaking that spell. So with that, we've looked at the animal likenesses of the beasts, different characteristics or attributes that papacy had taken on that were similar to the four universal empires that we read about in Daniel 7. And we went through that, and we discussed last week the verse 3, that one of the heads of the beast, seven heads, ten horns, one of the heads, that was the papal head of church and state, the Holy Roman Empire head, that lasted from 800 to 1799. On our list, we have it as the fourth head, and it was wounded by the Reformation, the sword of the Reformation, the sword of truth. And we got that from verse 14, Revelation 13, 14, which we discussed. But that the Counter-Reformation from 1545 through 1563 healed that wound. And the Counter-Reformation, in effect, reformed the Catholic Church to a certain degree against immoralities and other abuses that even many Catholics were aghast about. And so between the two, and then with our reformers falling off to a certain degree and not continuing to advance, they adopted some of the papacy's old practices of a church and state relationships, like the Lutherans in Germany, and then the Church of England developed, which we'll read later in this chapter, in the 1500s. And then it was also brought out that the Jesuits came into existence in 1540. The Jesuit order, which was part to help clean up the papacy's morality issues, but also we had the famous, to us he's famous, Jesuit monk, Ribera, who then created a false prophetic interpretation based on Daniel's 970 weeks of years, coupled it with the man of sin arising from the New Testament, and the reformers have been identifying the popes as the man of sin, and Ribera successfully converted their thinking over time that this man of sin was a future individual, not a line of popes, and that it would come about in the latter days. So they were deflecting this interpretation, which, by the way, you all know that evangelicals have largely accepted, contrary to what the reformers used to think and believe. So we were there with that through verse 3 and really verse 4, I believe. Well, I think we were all recognized that the dragon was a civil power that cooperated with the papacy and the bishops of Rome. And as we talked about, it developed from 533 with Justinian to 539 with Justinian, and then to 800 with Charlemagne. And that the people were wondering, they worshiped the beast, and they're saying, who is like unto it, who's able to make war with him? So the papacy in its heyday was, ruled Europe with a high hand. Brother Norm.
Yes, thank you for that overview. I just, while right here in the beginning of Revelation 13, I just noticed something for the first time in this verse 2, New International Version says, and we don't have to spend much time at all on this. I'm just wondering if someone might have a quick answer, because it's kind of a new thought to me. The beast I saw resembled... No, wait, it says, where did it go? And the seven heads with ten horns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. And that struck me as odd, because I've always thought, is this a mistranslation, or is this something, it's almost like if this is a correct translation, it's like, an identification of each head? Is there a name we could identify with each head that would be blasphemous? I know we've given thought to this, and, you know, I think we teach that it's the claims of the popes and in general. But is there anything more specific on this? Over.
So the King James, the Oxford edition in the margin, and that's in our version, it's the end of verse one that you read, upon his heads, the names, plural, of blasphemy. And we did discuss that because we did want to know, how that would be, how are the other, you know, seven heads. It's easy to put the eighth repeat head on this, but, you know, how is Napoleon a blasphemy? How is Victor Emmanuel a blasphemy? How was, the Nazi fascist a blasphemy? How was, the Goths blasphemy? How was Constantine blasphemy? When actually we're reading this under the papal beast rising up, which we have the blasphemy reiterated in verse 5, 6, and, they're specifically identified with the papacy, with blasphemy. So we did offer a thought on that last week, but or the week before even, but we'll open it up for the comments from the friends.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's a logical question, so we appreciate it. Ruth.
I was just looking at the diglot interlinear, and it says, on the heads of him, names of blasphemy. I think the NIV saying on each head was a name of blasphemy is kind of a liberty. Because that's not really what the interlinear reads. On the heads were names of blasphemies. So it wasn't so specific. So I think when we went over, we looked at it that as you see the beast, when it has the papal head, the whole beast takes over the identity of the papacy. So when you looked at the beast, you would see those names on the head of that particular head. That's in control. That's what I recall anyway. Over.
Yes. Because. Okay. Very good, Sister Carrie. Say something so we know if you're live. We're not hearing you say anything. Okay. I have to maybe leave and come back, see if that helps. All right. Sister Alice.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I'm looking at Brother Gene's notes on Revelation, and he says, when the bishops accepted Constantine as Pontifex Maximus, the chief religious ruler, they renounced the headship of Christ. This was blasphemy. Subsequently, no less than 62 blasphemous titles were applied to the Pope, second volume, page 307. Titles such as Most Divine of All Heads, Pontiff Supreme over All Prelates, Christ by Unction, Prince of Bishops, Infallible Pope. The papal rulers adopted blasphemous titles, and with these also came privilege, wealth, and power. So that's one explanation of it.
Yes, okay, good. Thank you. Now, before I call on Brother Adi, Sister Carrie, you want to try your sound?
Hello?
Oh, we hear you. All right, very good.
I was going to say in the Strong's, supporting what Sister Ruth said, that it says head, not heads, in the Strong's.
Okay. Appreciate that. Very good. Thank you. Brother Adi.
So Young's literal translation says upon its heads a name of evil speaking. So it's one common name on all the heads.
Okay. All right. Good. So I appreciate all the comments, the way I explained it, which makes sense to me, but it's just how it appeals to my mind is that when, John is shown the vision, he's not shown the beast with only one head. He has to be shown the beast with seven heads and 10 horns in order to recognize that it is the Roman Empire. And it's the beast of the Roman Empire under a specific head. Maybe the head takes the lead, and that would have been the fourth head. But we learn later in this chapter that in verse
We'll
cover that later. So that in my mind, it's just demonstrating that that John would see all seven heads and 10 horns, even though it's one head at a time that has the rulership. We learn that in the 17th chapter. So the name of blasphemy was associated with the head during the time period in which we are viewing it in the scripture context. And this is the papacy as the supposed Holy Roman Empire time period. So the head of the government has blasphemy associated with it. So, okay. Any other comments on this, or we'll just leave it there? Food for thought? Okay. All right. So let's go to verse 5. And Sister Cheryl, let's see. I was seeing you. Yeah. You want to read verse 5 through 7.
And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. We know this is our 1260 years, 539 to 1799. We know that's when the papacy had its most influential and powerful abilities. And I've been reading this paper. I came across, the seven last plagues, and I really don't know where I got it from. So I don't know, cause I know like Brother Ganos from Hercules Ganos from Greece sends me stuff from time to time. It could be from him, but, I was reading it last night, and in the fifth plague, it was bringing out, this was one of the, things that would be brought out, all the titles. How they've been wrong and how they've taken the place of God. So I'm kind of associating these blasphemies with the popes and bishops and cardinals and all these titles, that they did hold in this period. So I'm wondering if that is correct as being part of the fifth plague. That's a side point. You don't have to address it now, but that's kind of how I'm trying to relate the discussion. Over.
Okay, good. Now, appreciate that. I guess just a quick comment would just be that with the seven last plagues future, the fifth plague does demonstrate, the truth will be given that demonstrates that the papal claims were all blasphemous, that that was not theirs. They're not their titles, and they had no right to them. And that will be exposed. And you know, the thing is, that's what Brother Russell did with the second volume, where Sister Alice was quoting from Brother Gene, and we're all familiar with it in the Man of Sin chapter. These were some of the blasphemous titles Brother Russell was exposing as well. So that'll be that will be a truth. They'll be forced to drink it, as it were. Okay, good. Other comments here on these verses 5 through 7. Brother Chris.
Just to hearken back to our last Wednesday study of Daniel chapter 7, 7 and 8, this kind of reflects the teeth aspect, teeth of iron, that during these 1260 years, the Pope, the papal line, they had that power of excommunication and interdiction that was just terrifying to the people under their kings, and the kings wanted nothing to do with that either, so they were all kissing the toe of the Pope, as it were, over.
Yes. Yes, this was the, during the 1260 years, we had the heyday of the Inquisition in the 1100s, 1200s, into the 1300s, and even though there was effect by the reformers, yet the papacy still was a extremely formidable power, because it had crowned the emperor of the so-called Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, at the time of the Reformation. So it was, very dramatic still. And, all of us, we've all seen movies, on the reformers, different ones like, Zwingli and Tyndale and Luther, and they were being persecuted by the papacy, or the Church of England followed in the steps of papacy. So it was all very dramatic. But Brother David.
I think it was brought up last week, Brother Rick, on the mouth, like Brother Chris just brought out, that it's in verse 2, it says it's the lion's mouth, which is a fearful mouth. It's kind of copied from Babylon, in that they listened with fear because they knew something, could happen to them. There would be some kind of judgment proclaimed against them. Over.
All right. Good. Thanks. Ruth.
Just on verse 6, he blasphemed his name by claiming it for themselves, misrepresenting God's character. He blasphemed his tabernacle or church by replacing their own system of saints and clergy. So they blasphemed the true church. And then they blasphemed them that dwell in heaven, proclaiming sainthood for false saints and putting true saints to death. That's from the second volume.
Okay, very good. And that's we appreciate, because the tabernacle is a dwelling place, temporary. The heavens show those that are depicted as going to be in the reward. So the thought is that every aspect of God and his true people, including his son Jesus, have all been misrepresented, or their proper titles have been misappropriated by the papacy, whether it's God himself, the true saints, and Jesus, or the living saints still in the flesh. Brother Michael.
Yeah, I have a question on who gave the beast the authority to speak such thing. Is it the masses? Is it God? Is it the dragon? I mean, I'm just trying to understand, and I think this is an address, but please bear with me. Just trying to understand who gave him the authority to speak this way.
Okay, so the dragon, the civil authority, as we've been discussing, did give the title of supreme religious ruler to the papacy, the Bishop of Rome, and the papacy. It happened under Justinian I. So there was that perspective, the giving of the title Pontifex Maximus, chief religious ruler, or the head of all bishops, the head of all churches. These are all part of what Justinian I, the dragon, had given. And yet in another sense, because that helps fulfill these verses, in another sense, this was Satan's diabolical plan. For we learn that the false doctrines are the doctrines of demons. Apostle Paul writes that for us. So these are all actually demonic or satanic inspired claims by the adversary working through these fallen blinded humans, bishops and cardinals and popes to take on these claims, and their theologians. There's almost always some corrupt theologian behind all of these claims that writes it, and then a pope will adopt it usually. But anyone else on Brother Michael's question? Who gave the papacy the authority to make these blasphemous claims? Brother Dan.
Brother Rick, I was thinking of the fact that Satan usurped the authority that was rightfully Adam's back in the garden. God gave authority over man to rule over the lower creation and the earth, and Satan usurped that authority. So in this same way, we see that who gave papacy the authority, as you're bringing out, Satan is behind it, but they don't have the right to make these claims. We know they're all false claims. So it was in that sense, a usurped authority. They took something that didn't belong to them, and they, just like all these titles, belong to God and our Lord Jesus. Over.
Okay. Very true. Very good. Thank you. Other comments on this? Brother Chris.
Just from a different perspective, we read in chapter 17 that this harlot, with all of those pearls and precious stones, she did have a golden cup in her hand, even though she corrupted the contents horribly. So just the idea that originally the Catholic Church, she had all the Bible and these fragments of manuscripts and the truth, and it was all locked up, of course, as she perverted all of these truths through her lies and self-aggrandizement, as it were. But it also preserved the truth, sort of like Israel being in Babylon for their good, even though it was part of their punishment. It kept them protected as a people until the Lord would free it. And so, like the Bible, locked in the dungeons of the papal housing system and archives, when it was available, when it did finally come out, even at the end, here we had all these fragments and truths that supported the factuality and authority and of the scriptures. So God certainly didn't allow Babylon, didn't sanction it, didn't approve of it, didn't give any authority to it, but he did allow it. So we just from that angle, over.
You're not saying God gave the papacy the power to make these blasphemous claims. That's not what you're saying.
No, just the opposite.
Okay.
I'm just saying she had the golden cup, so they did have everything in the beginning before they locked it all up. He didn't give them the authority. The civil powers that were corrupted gave it to her, as you were saying.
Okay.
But he did allow it to, as a separation for the saints to come out of her, as a separation to those that recognize the truth, that those that had this true spiritual mind and recognized Jesus, it was a separation. So he used it. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I would say that God allowed it to happen. He didn't approve of it, but he allowed it to happen. But I just a side note, isn't it interesting how many ancient manuscripts came to light after papacy lost its power in the 1800s and so forth? So many of the ancient, they only had a couple, you know, but the ancient manuscripts that came to light afterward, you know, it's like the Lord bringing the light back to the world after papacy was sort of shut down. Over.
Okay, so true. Thank you. Ruth?
Well, in regard to the authority, in verse 2, the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So it's saying that the authority came from the dragon directly. And where does the dragon get it but from Satan, because he's the prince of this, the king or prince of this world. And when he was attempting to tempt Jesus, he said, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. And Jesus didn't dispute that he could. It's just that he rejected the offer. But anyway, so it came directly from the dragon. I don't think there's any way to construct that it came from anywhere else. Over.
All right. Thank you. Good. Brother Adi.
So the statement that the dragon gave the beast his power, just a question. I think it's future yet. It's a prophecy because it hasn't happened. This isn't a historical a statement, because it says that one of the heads had already been healed when it gave the beast the power. Is that correct?
Well, we think it happened back with Justinian.
But doesn't the dragon again give the beast his power in its yet future?
Well, in the future, the 10 horns will give the 8th head power for an hour. That's true. That part's true. But the civil power under Justinian, and then we talked about how Charlemagne gave the papal states to the Vatican. So they gave their power and their seat. They gave up even Rome. They gave it all, as it were, to the Bishop of Rome, the papacy, over a course of several centuries that we've been discussing, finalizing it by 800, so that the papacy, as the 4th head from 800 until Napoleon, it was the so-called Holy Roman Empire. So they had the power over all of Europe. They had the Inquisition, and they had the ability to persecute. They had the king subservient to them. Then they lost that under Napoleon. There was a gradual losing, but they lost it. It's true that the Reformation wound to that head, it was wounded, but it was like looking forward to what would happen to it. Not that the dragon would give his power after the Reformation, because when we look at verse 5, it tells us that he had this power for 42 months.
Yeah, I see.
Okay. So more food for thought here.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So in our verse, am I missing a hand? In our verse 7, it was given unto him, this beast, the papacy, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of the life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So in these couple of verses, we've already seen this symbol of kindreds, all kindreds, languages, and nations. We've already seen this in a number of other places in the Revelation. What does that represent for us again? Okay, so it shows a wide expanse of countries and tribes and land area with different peoples that are under the influence or control of the papacy, which was certainly true. We know that. There's no doubt on that. And it's just a way of emphasizing that this was throughout the Roman Empire and wherever the Roman Empire extended, including the papacy, wherever they formed their colonies, they took their beliefs with them. When the Spaniards came to the Americas, they brought Catholicism with them. When the Portuguese and Spaniards and French went to Africa, they took their religion with them. And so we grasp that. That's all part of how we've seen things develop. But I want to focus a little bit that we see that at the end of verse 4, it says, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Focusing on who can make war with that beast. And that in verse 7, it was given to him, the beast, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now, this is all during this 1260-year period. So those two phrases, as it were, what do they remind you of in the revelation that we've already discussed? What does it remind you of in the revelation that we've already discussed? Brother Chris.
Well, that would be chapter 12.
Okay.
With the war, Michael against the dragon and that battle that went on. Well, that war, of course, we know the papal system came out on top and pagan Rome went down. However, Rome converted at that point to Christianity. So by the time the popes were crowning Charlemagne, it was like, this is not possible to overcome. So now nobody's going to make war with the papal system, but the papal system now has the power to make war against anything that could possibly be a threat. So later, I mean, it was absolutely the height of their persecution in the 1200s. But they don't have any force. They're just a big mouth, but they have the civil authority that is now like Charles V, the great defender of the Catholic Church, and all these emperors and kings, they're the power. They're the ones that actually do the persecuting, that allow the deaths to take place, the fire and burning at the stakes, calling those that claim the way are now heretics. Anybody who says anything that even sounds remotely against the papal system is a heretic and worthy of death, which they were happy to carry out without blinking an eye. We know that from the second volume in detail. So it didn't destroy, when it overcame the saints, it didn't destroy the faith of the people. They just went into the wilderness condition. So what they overcame was their ability to openly worship the truth as they understood it by whatever seal was open to them. So like we read, they gathered in forests and woods and they would sing hymns, and if they had a scrap of scripture, it was very precious, and they would keep it in hiding and share it with one another as they had opportunity. So that was the height of the papal system, total dominance. Over.
All right, very good. Thank you. So in reflecting back on our entire Revelation study, we saw in the seven churches that from church number 3 through to church number 6, the papacy had a large control. We saw the same under the seals, which we read about, that by the time you got to the 5th seal, the church was hardly left. There were the souls of those under the altar crying out, "Oh, how long, O Lord?" And then under the trumpets, again, we saw how starting with the 3rd trumpet and onward, there was the rise of the papacy until the Lord sent some relief with truth. So this is what these verses are referring to very well. And I'd like us to take a look for a moment at Revelation 17. Let's take a look at Revelation 17. because we've gone verse by verse over that, I think we can safely look at it for a moment without getting too sidetracked. In Revelation 17, verse 11 through 14, 11 through 14, and let's see, Brother Adi, could you read that for us, please? Revelation 17, 11 through 14.
The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. So here the Lamb triumphs over the beast, whereas in the past it did not triumph. It failed. The beast triumphed over the Lamb, or God's people. But this is yet future, because it says it's only for 1 hour that they'll receive authority versus the 1260 years. Over.
Yeah, very good. So we wanted to see this emphasis that this eighth head is trying to, will try to do for a short period what we're reading the fourth head was able to do in the past. And we see Satan's goal through the papacy is to get it into a place where it can use civil authority to make war against Jesus' representatives on the earth once again. But when they do that, that will be their utter defeat, finally. So we just wanted to see the contrast, because it here's when we're reading in Revelation 13, it's the dark days during the 1260 years, the dark days. Here is the bright day that lies yet before us. Okay. Sister Debbie, you did have your hand up, but I talked. Did you want to make a comment? Okay. Any other comments here in 17? I just wanted to see that I wanted us to see the contrast. Okay. So back to 13. Was there any more comment on 5 through 7? We're going to talk more on 8, but anything more on 5 through 7? Everyone comfortable with that? Okay, so our verse 8, all them that dwell on the earth, let's identify what that symbol represents and worship him. And then let's talk about their names not being written in the book of life of the Lamb. And what does that represent? Let's break that down. Who could do that for us? Ruth?
Well, all that dwell upon the earth would be the people that are under the control of this beast, the religious restraint class. They shall worship him or accept the claims of being godlike, and only those whose names are not written in the book of life will worship the beast. Those that are the faithful ones, like the woman in Revelation 12, she will not worship the beast because her name is written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. But those that are not written in that book of life, which is the majority, will worship the beast. And I have a quote from a reprint. During her heyday of papacy's reign, the only ones not deceived were the true overcomers. It was so difficult to see to resist this incredible power that the only ones were those that were, whose names were written in the book of life, but reminds me of that, verse in Matthew 24, that what's ahead, the deceptions will be so great that possibly the very elect would be deceived. That's future, but still during this period, it was like that.
Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you. Bernard.
This has a direct connection with Revelation 14 and 15. Revelation 14 talking about the 144,000 being the faithful overcomers with their harps. And then Revelation 15 identifying that same group as being victorious over the beast. And they held harps given them by God. And I believe these would be the ones in the Lamb's Book of Life is the bride class. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yes. Sister Cheryl.
I appreciate, maybe it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, I always thought of the sea from verse 1 as just the irreligious masses. And you brought out it's more of the unrestrained religious masses. So we can see the development of coming out of the unrestrained religious masses to now becoming, being upon the earth and having the ability to restrain the religious masses. And it entails basically all except those that are saints of God that see the truth and walk in his ways. So I just appreciate that little bit of difference in the C class, just not the restless masses or irreligious, but they're unrestrained at that time. But now they are through papacy's power. Over.
Okay, thank you. Very good. Sister Carrie.
I have a question about, was it verse 8? It says, from the foundation of the world, and what is that referring back to, the Lamb slain or the names in not written in the book of life? It sounds like something was decided from the beginning of creation, but the Lamb wasn't slain from in the beginning of creation. But maybe it's just saying that it was, the plan was been formed from the in the foundation of the world.
Yes, and on that, Sister Carrie, you've answered your own question. How could that be?
I would think that there was a conversation that happened between the Father and the Son right at the beginning, that the Son was given this opportunity and he accepted it, perhaps.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Indeed, there was, must have been that. And even before that, God's plan must have devised that the means of saving the fallen race in the future would be dependent on this ransom through the Lamb of God, which he would give. But as you said, there would be, even though God had previously designed that, there would come a time when he would ask Jesus, if the great Logos, if he would be willing to do that. Okay, very good. Brother Dan.
Well, just the comment on from the foundation is the whole matter had been divinely arranged from before the creation of man. Everything pertaining to that slain lamb was foreknown by the Father. In the divine purpose, the ransom price was provided from before the foundation of the world. In another sense, when the contract was made between Jehovah and the Logos, and in another sense, when Jesus reached full human perfection at age 30. I thought that was pertinent.
Yeah, right on. Thank you. Okay, very good. So we like the distinction that was made that we studied in the past in Revelation, that there's a book of life which refers to all mankind who will be judged worthy in the future by the end of the millennial age. Through the little season, that those who have proved faithful through all their testing will be found worthy to be in the book of life, eternal life. But the book of the Lamb that seems to be special, as brought out to refer to those who would be the bride class, and perhaps even the great company might be included, but certainly those who had been of the spirit begotten class. Sometimes it refers to the little flock, but the great company aren't particularly mentioned. But if it's the divine nature, then it's just going to be the little flock. And then the great company would be, they get eternal life, and they would be included in that book of life in another sense. But it's not unusual not to find them openly included, because they're not a specially called class. The little flock is the called class. But okay, Ruth.
There's a cross-reference, a good one, in 1 Peter 1, 19. But with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you. Because when you read in Revelation 13, depending on the translation, sometimes it makes it sound like the names of those written on the earth, those on the earth that didn't worship the beast, were those names were written from the foundation of the world. So you have to go to these other verses.
Yes. Okay, good. So if anyone wanted to look into the more depth on those books of life, if you look back in the Revelation notes on Revelation, the third chapter, verse 5, you'll probably find a side study that we did there dealing with these four or five references to the book of life or the Lamb's book in Revelation. I think that would be, not that we're going to do that now. I'm just saying that in passing. I think the friends grasped this. All right. Thank you, Ruth. That helps pull that together. Was there anything more on verse 8? So our verse 9, as we know, it's kind of a this expression. If any man have an ear, let him hear. Where did we read a similar expressions? Where did we read similar expressions? Brother Chris.
Well, all through the various stages of the church, after each church, and statement given unto it, it's like, let the Spirit, those that can hear, let them hear what the Spirit saith. That's what I'm thinking of, over.
Yes, very good. So all seven stages of the church, that they close, the message to the church closes with that. Good. Sister Terry, saw your hand go up.
I don't know if this is pertinent, but in the when Jesus spoke the parables, he would end often with some version of that, a paraphrase of that.
Yes, that's thank you for bringing that out. That's one of my favorite connections. If we look in, let me see here, pick out the verse. Matthew 13, and Brother Godwin, could you read in Matthew 13, verse 9, please?
Matthew 13:9. Oh, it just says, it's the parable of the sower. It says, who have ears to hear, let him hear.
Okay. So at the end of this parable, before he interprets it, he gives this expression. You have a comment on what that might represent to us?
Nothing comes to my mind offhand, except for what I could relate to Sister Carrie saying, that Jesus often used that when he's trying to preach. Maybe the heart condition?
Yeah, for sure. And based on that, Brother Godwin, could you also read in Matthew 13, verse 16?
But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and ears, for they hear. So again, reiterating that, or reemphasizing that for those who have the condition at this age, you're blessed because the calling is special.
Yes. Very good. So we, was there any other comment in Matthew 13?
Thank you.
So let's take a look. Sister Nithya, is she willing to read there? Will you share the microphone, Brother Godwin?
She's following
Tamil. Oh, she's got a Tamil Bible, so it'll be hard for her to read that. So probably in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Sounds good. Brother Jeff, could you read for us in Revelation chapter 2 and verse, let's see, I just got to pick one here. Verse 7. 2:7.
Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God.
Okay. Any comment, Brother Jeff?
No.
Okay. Thank you. So, brethren, as Brother Chris brought out, after each of the seven churches, we have this expression, he that hath an ear, let him hear. And then the difference from Matthew 13 with the parable to here is that this says, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches, which we looked at and we studied the seven spirits before the throne of God were like seven lamps. And that represented the seven messages of the messengers that were given to each stage of the church. So each stage of the church is to identify their messenger of their time and hearken unto that, the message of what they're presenting. Because those seven messengers from the first chapter of Revelation were held in the right hand of Jesus Christ. And they were his special angel messengers for each of the seven time periods during the gospel age where he would send a messenger, provide a message that would encourage the true church. And so that's what we have in addition in the Revelation. In the Matthew 13, Jesus, the churches hadn't come yet. No one had been spirit begotten yet except Jesus. So it's just, Jesus just was pointing out that you have the lesson that you can hear words through your literal ears, but unless you have the heart condition, like Brother Godwin was saying, without the proper heart condition of humility and willingness to receive the truth, as we even say, it just falls on deaf ears. So, okay, we'll leave it there. Sister Debbie.
I always thought that when the scripture said this, if anyone, because it doesn't say it often, but when it says it, that you're supposed to pay extra attention, am I wrong with that thought? Over.
I always thought that too, just like you. Thank you. Brother James, Sister Molly.
Yes, thank you. I was thinking with an ear to hear, that's like, it reminds me of my high school days when I learned foreign language. So I took some years of Japanese language. Well, I could barely remember any of it because I haven't practiced it. So if I hear it, it doesn't make any sense to me anymore. I can't really speak anything because I haven't been practicing it. I haven't been doing it at all. So it's like the idea of having an ear is like you have to hone your ear. You have to work at it. So I was putting that with 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 15. I'm reading out of the NIV, so it doesn't have the familiar ring to it, but, do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a workman who does not need to be ashamed and who correctly handles the word of truth. So that's dividing the word of God. Over.
All right. Very good. Yes. We appreciate that. Very nice. Ruth.
I don't know if anyone else has this note. In my margin, it says this is the eighth and last time in the book of Revelation where this is said. And it's particularly underscoring that this identification of worshiping this entity of the beast in this particular chapter is like one of the chief burdens of this book, that those that are names are written in the book of life are the ones whose ears are hearing it. And so it's particularly connecting it with verse 8. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Nope, I think that makes sense to me. Those who are in the Lamb's Book of Life. All right, very good. We're going to pick up a reiteration of a new phrase in our following verse, but that's a very good point. Sister Debbie.
Just Brother Steve wanted to mention that it reminds him of when a parent would grab the kid's earlobe to get him to go where he wanted him to go. You know, you grab your ear and pull you along back in the day. Over.
Okay. I guess that would be true. Thank you. My mind was going to another place. You don't need to turn here. I'll just remind you of it because you've studied that in the Tabernacle Shadows, that in, let me just get the right verse. Take me a second. So it's in Leviticus 8. It's in verse 23, but like I say, you don't need to turn there. It's in the consecration of the priesthood, and it says, how he slew the ram of consecration, and Moses took the blood of it and put it on the tip of Aaron's right ear and upon the thumb of his right hand and upon the great toe of his right foot. And it goes on. But we know in our study of the tabernacle that the ear was showing that to the consecrated, they're hearing the word of the Lord and acting upon it. Walking in the way of truth, the foot, and engaged in serving the truth upon the hand, and the right shows favor. But I'm just linking that you had the blood of consecration on the priesthood was demonstrating that their ear is open to the word of the Lord and His instruction. So just a little further symbology there is all. Okay. Any other comment on our verse 9? Okay, let's read another verse here. It's our verse 10. And see, Sister Alice, would you like to read verse 10 for us, Revelation 13:10?
He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints.
Oh, opening comment, Sister Alice?
Well, if one would be going, acknowledging papacy and its claims, then it will... that one would suffer the same thing that papacy would. It would go down. And if they are with papacy, when papacy is wounded by the sword, they will also be wounded because they will have the same result of as papacy would have.
Very good. All right. Appreciate that. So let's take those first two symbols as brought out by Sister Alice of the emphasis. He that leads, and I'm going to add a few words in here for us today. I don't know, today's English. He that leads others into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. So it, we believe, as brought out, this is the papacy that takes people captive with their errors. Just as the picture brought out earlier, how Babylon, literal Babylon, took literal Israelites into captivity. So mystic Babylon was taking spiritual Israelites into captivity, as it were, with their false doctrines and their false practices. And yet, what's going to happen is the papacy will be taken captive. The papacy has suffered continual blows since its heyday of power. It's been continued to be knocked down, but will finally also be destroyed eventually. And as the papacy kills with the sword of excommunication, let alone literal sword, so too those who follow papacy into their captive, being captive to their doctrines and false practices, must also be killed with the sword. And if the sword is truth, here as a rebounding, it would demonstrate that the truth, as it wounded the papal head under the Reformation, those Reformation truths would wound or kill those that had adopted the papal doctrines or practices. So there's that kind of a sense. So what the papacy has done with the symbolic captivity and sword, and those who follow her, that's similarly how they will suffer under God's retribution. But other comments on that? Sister Debbie, and then Ruth.
So what it's saying is that because papacy took people captive and, you know, figuratively killed them with the sword, that's what's going to happen to papacy, is basically what this is saying. Over.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. They're going to get what they gave. And as already the process has started. Ruth.
I was thinking of the, also, it's like the same principle as if you remain in her, you'll receive of her plagues. Now that's an end of the age picture, but those that were in her and not only were in her, but were influencing and defending her, he that leadeth into captivity, he that killeth with the sword, the ones that were active proponents, suffered in their characters because of it, and they'll have to have a lot to answer for in the kingdom. Over.
Yes, very good. I do like that it's a process. It continues. Very good. Sister Alice.
I'd like to mention and read something about the 42 months, if you have any time for that.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is from, of course, this was when Napoleon took the Pope. But, only I could find it. Oh, here it is. Okay, this is one of the most interesting things. Napoleon, his general, went to the Sistine Chapel where the Pope lived on the same day, February 15th, on the anniversary of Pope Pius the VI, when he was made Pope. And they were celebrating the anniversary, and in the middle of the ceremony, there were Napoleon's general, Haller, a Swiss Calvinist, who is not papacy, came in with a band of his soldiers, broke into the chapel, and declared that the Pope's reign was at an end. The Swiss guards were dismissed, and the soldiers took over, and the cardinals were stripped of their authority and possessions, and 8 were arrested. And they took over the papal palace, And then at night, they came and they, February 20th, 1798, it was a stormy night with lightning and thunder when the carriage crossed the city, preceded by two men with torches, the guards pointing out the dome of St. Peter's, and they took Pope Pius VI, and they went and they stopped at they were going to France, and they stopped at an Augustinian convent. And while they were there, an earthquake destroyed buildings. And the Pope was housed outside the city in a country home called Hell. And then he died at Valence, France in 1799. To me, this is a interesting termination of papacy in 1799, but we know it was only a temporary for Napoleon, the 1260 years. But I love this story where he was taken at midnight and then he dies in a place called Hell. That's all.
Yeah, very fitting. Very interesting. Okay, good. Brother Chris, Sister Debbie, quick comments, please.
Yeah, I was just going to bring out that this conversion of being killed by the sword that goes back to our they shall overcome the saints. So those that were in the wilderness condition under such the heavy hand of papacy upon them, some of them just could not hold out, and they were converted or killed into Catholicism just to survive, as it were. And so there would be an aspect of that, because back in chapter 9 under the fifth angel's message, Wycliffe, we have in verse 5 that unto them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And the friends can look back at their note on that. But being killed equals conversion, a change of condition over.
Okay, very good. Very good. So true. Sister Debbie.
Just real quick, I wanted to bring out Deuteronomy 19:18-21, and it's eye for an eye, life for a life, tooth for a tooth. And that's basically, I think, what this verse is saying also. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, brethren, we'll pick up with this closing phrase in verse 10 next week, Lord willing. If you have a chance to look at this phrase, here is the patience and the faith of the saints. It's reiterated several times in the Revelation, so we will want to take a look at that. And then, if your schedule permits, if you haven't recently, you might enjoy rereading the long 12-page foreword. It's not the 1916 foreword, it's the long foreword to the fourth volume, where Brother Russell addresses much of the verses to come. It'd be good review. So.